Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at WILL.UIUC.edu.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we are very privileged and honored to have as our guest on the air with us the Honorable Michael Copps, Commissioner from the Federal Communications Commission. He'll be joining us to talk about the FCC, media ownership, media policy issues, the internet, the whole waterfront of crucial communication policy issues facing the United States today. We'll have him for the full hour, but first, before we go to Michael Copps, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Youth Media Council is a group dedicated to building an intergenerational movement for racial justice. The council works throughout the San Francisco Bay Area to help youth and racial justice groups develop communication strategies and challenge the ways they're often misrepresented in the media. Malkia Cyril is the director of the Youth Media Council.
We understand that no matter how strategic your message is, no matter how well-framed, no matter how skilled your spokespeople, if you don't have access to the content, if you're not able to influence the outlet, if you don't have the kind of media rules in the media system that allow you to move that strategic message, then you won't get anywhere.
Before founding the Youth Media Council in Oakland 6 years ago, Cyril worked for 10 years as an organizer. But her earliest influence came from her mother's involvement in community activism as a Black Panther in Brooklyn, New York.
I witnessed quite a number of people that I loved and that I considered to be my family rot in jail for 25 years to life. And I witnessed the news coverage even years later, decades later, these radical, progressive African-Americans. It was horrible. It was biased, it was criminalizing, and it was dehumanizing. I understood very early and very thoroughly that both because of the choices that existed in my own life as a direct result and what I witnessed through the campaigns that I worked on, that media is both a threat to communities of color and poor people and women and queer people and all disenfranchised communities, and it is an extremely important opportunity that one cannot afford to ignore. So from that lens, I really decided that doing communications training, for example, and capacity building was not enough. Doing direct PR was not enough. Doing media activism or media policy reform was not enough. We had to combine the three to really provide a comprehensive institution. Movement institution.
The Youth Media Council is making a difference. They launched the Unplug Clear Channel campaign after the radio giant began decreasing community affairs programming on a local hip-hop station. As a result of their grassroots pressure, they increased programming from local artists and added a show hosted by young activists.
We are not doing this because we care so much about the media. We're doing this because we care about the policies that result for media bias. And so the media is an infrastructure that mediates public conversation. So we want to make public conversation about the things we care about mediated in a fair and just way to produce the results of justice.
For more information about the Youth Media Council, go to www.youthmediacouncil.org.
An increasing number of Americans are unhappy with the quality of television news. A recent survey by pollster Frank Luntz says that 47% of American adults rate the current coverage of international news as fair or poor. And that's hardly surprising. As world affairs become increasingly complex and U.S. troops are engaged in long-term fighting abroad, a need to understand the issues and the cultures involved is more urgent than ever. Yet American news organizations are cutting back international coverage. Major papers like the Boston Globe and the Baltimore Sun have abandoned their foreign news bureaus altogether. Only a few papers have maintained offices abroad. And although more than 80% of the public gets their news from television, the major networks have shut down several offices in major cities like Moscow, Paris, and Beijing. The Washington Post reported that, aside from a one-person ABC bureau in Nairobi, there are no TV network offices left in Africa, India, or South America. The Luntz poll suggests that Americans are now realizing they are missing a large portion of world affairs, and they don't seem to care if the news comes from sources other than American news outlets. Almost two-thirds of cable subscribers said they would be interested in a 24-hour BBC news channel.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest is the second-term FCC Commissioner, Michael Copps, joining us from Washington, D.C., from his office for our program. We're recording this show a few days before going on air, so please don't try to call in. Let us do the talking for you. Commissioner Copps, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob. I'm delighted to be with you and your listeners today.
Well, we've had you on the show before, and we've had Jonathan Adelstein as well on our program, and I know from our listener response, these are some of the most popular shows we've ever aired on Media Matters. And I think one of the things that people enjoy is hearing how the FCC actually works, because it, as important an organization as it is in the U.S. federal government and as our media system, it's mostly not misunderstood or not understood at all by the preponderance of Americans who know very little about it. If you wouldn't mind, just tell us a little bit, what is the FCC, what does it do, and how does it work?
Well, the Federal Communications Commission is an independent regulatory body that was set up back in the 1930s. It really was a precursor before that, but it took the name of the FCC in the Telecommunications Act of 1934. It is composed of five members. Three from the party that is controlling the White House at that particular time, and two from the opposition political party. Our job, basically, is to implement the telecommunications statutes as passed by Congress, and this would include telecommunications, plain old telephone service, more advanced telecommunications, and we can talk more about that later because we're still kind of battling over what that means from the standpoint of the FCC and protecting the public interest in broadband and things like that. It involves oversight of our precious public airwaves, radio and television, to a lesser extent satellite and cable. It involves the satellite industry. We are involved in international harmonization and the use of spectrum. We're responsible for auctions of spectrum, oversight of the wireless spectrum and industry. So it's a pretty wide-ranging charge that we have.
Well, one of the things, Michael Copps, that distinguishes the FCC that William Kennard, the former chair, liked to talk about from other regulatory bodies, say the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is that it doesn't simply regulate existing industries, but rather it has the power through licensing to create industries. I mean, so the FCC is in some respects economically arguably the most powerful commission in Washington because vast fortunes and huge industries are created by whoever you give the monopoly license to.
Well, I think there's much to be said in that, and the reason that we have that much influence is that we are supposed to be stewards over the public airwaves. And I think you know your show's called Media Matters. This stuff really does matter. I think you can make the case that telecommunications/media is far and away the most important part of the American economy and American society. I don't think there's another industry that comes close in terms of, and I'm talking not just about economic and commercial impact, but cultural, social, and political too. Media matters. Media is how we as a people converse with one another over and above our daily personal relationships and talking to one another. This is how we converse as a nation, how we entertain ourselves as a people, and how we make decisions that will chart the future destiny of our country.
Now, there are five members of the FCC. You're one of the two Democratic members. You're in your second term. You first joined the Federal Communications Commission in 2001. How does it work? Do the five, and then the staff is a couple thousand people, as I understand it. Do the five of you guys sit around in robes and debate how the world should work?
Or? Actually, oddly enough, the five of us can't sit around and talk at all unless it's in a public meeting. This is something that I've really been trying to get changed here, but we have something called the open meeting rules, and Congress decided back in the Watergate days, in the shadows of Watergate, that decisions should be completely open and discussions completely open, and I share that abhorrence with government in smoke-filled rooms and all of that, but I do think that there ought to be an exception where five commissioners can get together and talk and hash some of these decisions out. I can't think of any decision that we've made in the 6 years I've been here that probably would not have been enhanced if we had had that ability at some point, at least once or twice, to come together as a group and say, here's our entering thoughts, or here's our midterm thoughts, or here's our thoughts right before we vote on how this particular procedure should be handled. I don't know any other institutions other than these regulatory bodies that are expected to operate that way. Certainly the courts don't operate that way. Justices talk to one another. Certainly Congress does not act that way. The members are always talking and bargaining with one another. I happen to be of Catholic religion. I know the College of Cardinals doesn't work that way. So I think if the ability to meet and all that is good enough for Congress and good enough for Holy Mother Church, it ought probably to be good enough for the Federal Communications Commission, too.
Yeah, it seems on the surface that solution is to the wrong problem. The problem is more with commercial interest having undue influence over the policymaking process.
Well, you're absolutely right, and one of the strong emphasis I've had ever since I came here is what we do matters so much. Again, media matters to everybody in America, and we're talking about the stewardship of a public resource. We need to be reaching out to every stakeholder, and that doesn't just mean the corporate interests who have a high-priced lawyer or a team of lobbyists here in town, but that means people who represent consumers. It means free press, it means labor unions, but it means getting out to organizations representing people in the inner cities. It means getting out to Native Americans. Everybody is impacted by these decisions, and we have a duty as a regulatory agency to get out and do that. And I think there's been too much of the mentality over the years that, well, we're just, we put our little green eye shades on and sit here and parse the law and look at submissions from the usual corporate lobbyists and all, and then make a decision. That's not the way this place should operate at all. Congress entrusted us with some pretty far-reaching policy ramifications for the American people, and we should be holding our meetings around the country, not just in Washington, D.C., and we should be always telling people, this is what we're considering doing, these are the rules we're considering passing, what do you think about these rules, instead of just like a bolt of thunder or lightning from the sky or Moses coming down from the mountain with the commandments, come down with a new rule. This should be bottoms up and not top down.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is Honorable Michael Copps, Federal Communications Commission Commissioner since 2001, joining us on the phone from his office in Washington. And because we're airing on Sunday, you know that we're pre-recording this because as hard as you work, Commissioner Copps, I hope you're not working Sunday afternoons at your office.
Sometimes that happens.
Okay. So don't call in today. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. We've got a lot of ground to cover. You know, we've been talking just now, Commissioner Copps, about how traditionally the FCC's work has been, to a large extent, unknown to Americans, but very well known to commercial interests that have a strong stake in the outcome. That began to change, or is beginning to change, and I think the event that put the FCC on the map for millions of Americans, or the series of events, and that made you a much more prominent name, as well as the other commissioners, was in 2002 and 2003 when the Federal Communications Commission, began reviewing the media ownership rules, a process that's still going on today at the FCC. And maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, what are these media ownership rules? Why do we have them in the first place? I mean, why don't we just rely on antitrust rules in this area? And what happened, from your view, in 2003?
Well, that was really part of the an important part of the education of Mike Copps, to understand that people around the country really had an interest in the rules that we have here, and could find ways to express that. Thanks to leadership of groups like Free Press, I know you've been very much involved in efforts to get the word out around the country, and it was amazing to me. We have had, over the years, some constraints upon ownership limits in the media, the number of outlets that one particular company could own. Predicated on the idea that media is better served if it has a large dose of localism attached to it, that programming to a large extent comes out of localities, reflects community interests, community issues. Those rules are predicated on the fact that we should have diversity of opinion, so that there's a clash of ideas, and that the media is used as a public forum and as part of the democratic process, the participatory process of the people in the future of their government. And those rules have been predicated upon the idea that we should have competition, that people ought to be competing for the use of these airwaves, and to be stewards of the airwaves rather than just turning them over to large corporate interests. In 2003, shortly after I got here, then FCC Chairman Michael Powell came with some rather far-reaching proposals to do away with a lot of the safeguards that we had on media ownership, to the extent that under those proposed rules, one company would have been able to own in some of the markets in the country up to three television stations, eight radio stations. The newspaper, which is already a monopoly, as your listeners know, in most areas, most cities of the country. The cable channels, the cable system, the internet service provider, and you have to ask yourself, gee, how does that serve localism and diversity and competition if you're turning that much commercial and social and cultural and political influence over to just a very limited number of players? Well, Mr. Powell, to make a long story short, rammed those rules through the commission, didn't put them out for the people to see or judge beforehand. Commissioner Adelstein and I vigorously protested and vigorously dissented. But then, thanks to the work of a lot of the consumer groups and interests, and some folks on the Hill, and folks out around the country, word started to get out, and it got out to Congress, too. So people were paying attention at this point in time, and because of that, Congress, the Senate Commerce Committee, actually voted to overturn what the Powell rules within 17 days of their passage here at the commission, and then the full Senate went on twice to say no dice with those rules. The House voted to overturn parts. Had it been allowed to vote on the whole package, which it wasn't, it would have done the same thing. But meanwhile, the opponents of those rules went to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, and they sent those rules back to us. We heard during this process from 3 million American citizens. When I came here in 2001, if you had told me that 3 million Americans even knew there was a place called the Federal Communications Commission here on the shores of the Anacostia River in Washington, D.C., I would have been surprised, but they found out. And the good news here is that citizen action can still work. You know, lots of times we think, oh, we're just cogs in the wheel and we don't have any control, but when the people get interested, the people can still make a difference. So we managed to check those rules from going into effect. That's the good news. Citizen action works. That's the good news. The reality check now is that we're back at square one at the FCC, and we have a new chairman here and several new members, but we are looking again at those ownership rules. We're mandated by Congress to look at them every 4 years. It's generally agreed, I think, that Chairman Martin would like to probably do something to weaken or to loosen the ban on newspaper broadcast cross-ownership, and maybe some of the other rules, too. We won't know that until we see what cards he's going to put on the table, but we need to be prepared, because I think that same or a similar regulatory mentality is still in the saddle, that the market basically makes good decisions and the market sufficiently protects the public interest, which I think is hogwash. But anyhow, we have that mentality. So I'm worried here that in the closing part of this year, or at the latest first quarter of next year, that there might be a move from within the commission to go down that road again of trying to loosen some or maybe several of these rules. And you know the broadcasters and the newspapers and all those folks might be saying they're not interested in consolidation anymore, but all you got to do is realize, you know, we have all these big merger proposals before us, XM Sirius, News Corp and Dow Jones, Chicago Tribune with new ownership and all, to see that. And I've read all the submissions of industry. They're still following that Pied Piper of consolidation. So we need to be prepared. We can't be lulled, and I think we've been lulled for the last 6 months or a year, that maybe nothing is going to happen now that the political equation has changed a little bit. But I think unless there's evidence that the people are once again mobilized, that there is action at the grassroots, that this crowd might try to do something that would end up significantly loosening these ownership rules.
Commissioner Michael Copps, our guest today on Media Matters from the Federal Communications Commission. Commissioner Copps, characteristically, you're being quite modest, and since I'm not bound to be modest for you, I should say that 3 million people that came out in 2003 to register their concern about media concentration in their communities and nationally, a lot of that was generated because you took the leadership as a member of the Federal Communications Commission to say, we really want to hear what people have to say. You opened the door, basically, and said, let me hear what your thoughts. Moreover, you and Commissioner Adelstein, who joined you that year on the commission, went out to a series of public hearings around the country in 2003, I think at least a dozen. And those events were extraordinary, were they not?
Well, you're very kind, and I appreciate that. But the essential point is here that once you tell the people what's at stake, they get this. You know, I think Chairman Powell and some of the industry folks thought, oh, this is so arcane. People in the United States don't care about this stuff. What's the contour overlap of radio signals or television signals, or precisely how many outlets can one company control? But I'll tell you, when you tell people about this, and that this little commission, you know, in Washington, D.C. is mucking around with their airwaves and doing it in secret with results that might only further harm localism and diversity and competition, they get that real fast. They become downright proprietary about those airwaves. So So I think it's an issue that has a lot of traction, but I'm happy to, that you think those hearings played a productive role. Jonathan and I, Commissioner Adelstein and I, tried to go to as many of these hearings as we could when it became clear that Chairman Powell didn't want to do many hearings. He went to one or two, I think, but people all around the country wanted to have some input into this, so we went to hearings that were organized by members of Congress or communities or free press or other groups like that. I've probably been to, gee, I don't know, 3-4 dozen, maybe even more of them than that, and you hear the same concern. It's amazing. You go into a city, and say you're going into a city with a lot of consolidated media, that newspaper not going to publish the story. They don't want to highlight the business model that they're maybe profiting inordinately from. So a lot of times they don't even print anything about you coming or broadcast anything. But still, word seeps out thanks to these groups, and 300, 400, 500, 600 people will show up in the evening to vent their feelings and ask what's happened to local news. Why so much homogenized programming? Where is the real vitality and dynamism and diversity? Why no minority voices on the media? And we hear that wherever we go. So it's a tremendous issue. And to me, you know, I get maybe some people think I get a little carried away on this issue. But to me, if this media ownership issue is not your listeners' number one priority, it ought to be their second. And I understand there are lots of important issues out there, and I'm concerned about them too. There are questions of war and peace. How do we educate our kids? How do we find health insurance for 45, 50 million people that are uninsured in the United States? How do we keep a job amidst the climate that we're in right now? These are all terribly important questions, but all of them right now are primarily funneled through that filter of big media. So it's coming through that corporatized media the way they want it to come through. And as a result, we're not getting that clash of antagonistic ideas. We're not even getting a lot of the fundamental issues teed up for Americans to consider. And that's a denial of democracy. I mean, we all believe in democracy. We all believe in the premise that if you give people adequate depth and breadth of information, that they will make decisions that more often than not are good for the country. You believe that, I believe that, I hope all of us believe that. But I think that partly because of this consolidation we've had in the media, we are skating perilously close as a country to denying our folks that kind of information they have to make really informed, intelligent decisions for the future of the country.
Our guest, Michael Copps, today in Media Matters. Again, I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Again, this is pre-recorded, taped a few days before going on air, so please sit back, relax, listen, let us do the talking. Commissioner Copps, one of the consequences also of the 2003 battle over media ownership rules was that the commission agreed to hold a series of hearings, public hearings, before it revisited the rules again, as you're doing currently. And you've had 4 of these hearings so far, is that correct?
We've had 4 of the hearings so far. We have a 5th one that is scheduled for Chicago on September 20th. I hope a lot of concerned citizens will come out for that. And then the chairman has indicated that we would have one after that. Now, Commissioner Alstein and I asked for a lot more hearings, because we need to go into a diversity of media markets. We need to go into different sections of the country to learn what's going on there and to hear what people really think about how their media is serving or disserving them. So I wish we had more, but they're coming to a close. So as I say, we have the Chicago one, and he'll probably do one more. And we also have I detect a quickening pace around here.
Mm-hmm.
The hearings are winding up. We did some, the chairman contracted for some media ownership studies, and they took a good bit of time to produce, but all of a sudden they're produced, and now they're putting them out for a rather short comment period. So that's why I'm a little bit suspicious about maybe something's going to happen around here sooner rather than later, and that's why I say be vigilant and be prepared. be ready to act.
Well, this will certainly be an issue we will be covering here on Media Matters. So listeners who stay tuned here will keep you apprised of the situation and let you know how you can participate in the future. The first four hearings, two last year were in, I believe, Los Angeles and Nashville. Then this year, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Portland, Maine. And now we're coming up to the Midwest one in Chicago on September 20th.
And we had one in Tampa, St. Pete's.
Oh.
The one in Portland, and this gets needlessly complicated maybe, the one in Portland was actually part of the localism hearings that Chairman Powell instituted as kind of a reaction. He got all this criticism for not having media ownership hearings, so while he was getting a lot of this in the summer right after he pushed those rules through here, he decided he would have localism hearings. And incidentally, that's an important proceeding, too, and we have no business voting on new ownership rules until that localism proceeding is wound up, too, because that's what this is. That's what this is all about.
Absolutely. Could you just give a sense, though, in these big public hearings that have been held in the last 6 months or so, or 7 or 8 months, what have the five commissioners experienced? What are the American people saying when they go out to talk to them about media ownership?
Well, we encourage a diversity of viewpoints. We invite broadcasters and industry people to come in, so they come in, and it's pretty predictable what a lot of them are going to say, but it's important. And let me say that I think there are a lot of broadcasters, or many broadcasters around this country, in whose breast the flame of the public interest still burns. I think there are stations that are serving their local communities generally well. It's just that in this consolidated environment in which we live, it's more and more difficult for them to be captains of their own fate, and more are they captives of this unforgiving expectation of the Wall Street and Madison Avenue and all of that. So it's harder for them to do their job, and fewer of them are able to do it. More and more of them have sold out to the large corporations. And what we hear when we go into many of these cities from average citizens, and folks like to be referred to as citizens and not consumers when it comes to this, and I understand that that distinction. What we're hearing is a lot of concern about what has happened where there has been consolidation. They feel that newsrooms have been cut back. They feel that a lot of stuff is being distanced, cast in. Even the news, not just the weather, but the news itself, oftentimes. They see a lot of the local entertainment, local musicians, local artists who used to get play time on the radio. Now don't get it anymore because you have this corporatization of and homogenization of music to such an extent that people say, you know, we can get in our car in Los Angeles, California, turn on the radio and drive across the United States and you'll hear the same 20 songs. You won't hear the distinctive music when you go through Austin or New Orleans or Appalachia or up to Detroit and Motown or any of a dozen other things that you can mention. So, you know, that's a tremendous price to pay because you're not only ignoring the artists there, but you're really kind of dampening down creativity itself in favor of something much less valuable. So we hear that. We hear that you're not getting community issues covered anymore. We're hearing that the only news they get is if it bleeds, it leads, and why aren't political campaigns here covered more? We didn't see any reporting on our House of Representatives race. That's a pretty important race, but I can testify to that here. I mean, I can't remember seeing three really good in-depth reports on our local House of Representatives race before the last election. So there's a whole panoply of complaints that we hear. People think something is missing. They do feel proprietary about their airways. They do want something done about it, and they want not only bad new rules not to be passed. They want bad new rules to be defeated. But what I sense in the last year or so is let's get on the offensive on this. Let's not just avoid bad new rules, but let's revisit some of the bad old rules that got us into this mess in the first place. And for heaven's sake, let's figure out a way to reinvigorate the people's airways with some specific public interest obligations like we used to have and have no longer.
Yeah, this has been one of the issues. You've done a great deal of work, Commissioner Copps, to bring to the public's attention. You wrote a piece for the New York Times in June of this year that got a lot of attention. And just talk a little bit about this whole principle of the public airways that, as you say, has been lost to a large extent.
Well, the public airways are there to serve the people. We decided long ago that broadcasting, I guess, would be part of the great capitalist system, so nobody is out to deny broadcasters the right to earn a good living as they fulfill their roles as stewards of the public airways. But in return for that, the deal was, the quid pro quo was, to serve the public interest, which is a term that is mentioned some 112 times in the Telecommunications Act, so I think Congress intended us to take that obligation to serve the public interest seriously. And unfortunately, we've gotten away from the specifics of all of that. For years and years, we had guidelines. We had 12 or 14 different guidelines by which we judged whether a station was serving the public interest. Are you teeing up controversial issues? Are you covering community affairs? Are you go out and talking to your listeners to see the kind of programming that they want? Are you covering, used to be, do you have agricultural reports? And when we were much more agricultural than we are now, religious programming, all sorts of different things. And those weren't a list of absolutes that you had to meet every one of them, but it was a list that broadcasters understood. We put next to their license renewal application when it came in and made a judgment on whether they were making a good faith effort to serve the public interest in terms of those kinds of things. And we used to require that broadcasters come in every 3 years to get their license renewed, and that's how we judged it. Well, fast forward now to the present day, we no longer require any of that. We say every 8 years, not every 3 years anymore, every 8 years, why don't you just send in a postcard saying you'd like your license renewed, and that'll be fine. We'll send it back by return mail, and it's almost that simple. It's called postcard renewal for a good reason, and about the only reason you would find a license renewal application being denied these days would be if there was some sort of character charge against the owner of a station, if there were spouse abusers or child beaters or something like that. But taking away a license on public interest grounds is just something that doesn't happen anymore. So I have been advocating, and what I advocated in this little op-ed piece in the New York Times is that we go back to having a licensing system every 3-4 years where we would have a set of public interest obligations crafted for the new realities of the 21st century, but that everybody would understand, broadcasters would understand it, the American people would understand it, and I think that would go a long way toward returning some of the things to the airwaves that we have needlessly sacrificed over the past 20 years.
My name is Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Our guest today, the Honorable Michael Copps, FCC Commissioner, joining us on the phone from his office in Washington, D.C. We've been talking about media ownership rules, which the FCC is in the process right now of returning to and evaluating with the prospect of loosening up the number of monopoly radio and TV licenses a single company can have, those scarce licenses, and with that also the ability to buy local newspapers and set up local monopolies in communities with one owner, oftentimes based elsewhere, owning most of the media with one newsroom fitting all in that community. Commissioner Copps, at this point I can imagine a significant number of our listeners have already said to themselves, but Commissioner Copps, what about the Internet? Now that everyone's got a website, now that everything's online, does it really matter who owns the local radio or TV station?
You bet it does, because media matters, and that's media too. And you raise a really important question, because it's almost it's the same kind of an issue, this stewardship of the public airwaves. Who's going to control the distribution? Who's going to control the content, and are we going to let that be the same person? That's what these ownership rules in the media are all about. that issue is now confronting us in the internet. And it's so interesting to me because when we went through this ownership debate 3-4 years ago, the internet community wasn't as concerned with it as I think they are today. Back then, they were fearing government involvement, and they were saying, here we have this open and dynamic new technology, and don't even mention anything about government regulation or anything like that. We're just fine. Thank you very much. About 2 years ago, when I was making the rounds on these media ownership hearings, people started standing up and saying, wait a minute, all these ills that have been visited upon media by this increasing consolidation, I think that's beginning to happen on my internet. I visited the top 20 news sites on the internet, and guess what? They were owned by the very same people that own all the other stuff, and the broadcasting and the cable. And they got interested in this issue of net neutrality and making sure that those big telecom companies, the big network providers who control the distribution of this, don't also have veto power and gatekeeper control over the content that runs on the internet. So here we have this wonderful new dynamic technology, perhaps the most dynamic maybe ever, certainly since the printing press, and we have our more fundamental airwaves that we've been using as our main means of communication. These two critical parts of our infrastructure, both threatened by the very same kind of consolidation and, to some extent, the very same consolidators themselves. So anybody who's concerned about the one ought to be concerned about the others. Now, I think the Internet is a wonderful tool for democracy. I think it produces, instant commentary on the news, instant analysis. But it has not supplanted traditional media, and it's not going to supplant traditional media, I don't think, for a long time. Getting to the news is serious, sustained, expensive business. If you're really going to cover this world of ours, you have to have staff, you have to have resources, you have to have bureaus around the country, you have to have bureaus around the world, and it's a profession. And it takes serious commitment of resources. And a lot of the folks on the Internet don't have that kind of resources. Plus, as I said before, a lot of the news sites and a lot of the news that appears on the Internet is produced by the consolidated enterprises to begin with. So I think the Internet does not divert us from these other problems or say we don't have a problem in the media anymore because of the Internet. Quite the contrary, we got to be awfully darn sure that we don't let the problems that bedevil the media bedevil and deny the promise of this new technology of broadband and the Internet.
My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our guest today, the Honorable Michael Comps, FCC Commissioner, joining us on the phone from his office in Washington. We pre-recorded this show slightly before going on air, so please don't try to call in. Sit back, relax, let us do the talking. Commissioner Comps has been talking about media ownership, internet policy, the crucial policies the FCC is considering that will shape the media system for the coming generation. Commissioner Comps, recent surveys and studies have shown that the United States has now fallen well behind most other leading countries in terms of broadband access and speed. We were at one time the leader internationally on hooking people up to the internet at high speed. Then we fell to the top three, and now we're down, depending on the study, between 15 and 25 and falling. Why is this, and what can we do about it?
Well, excuse me, it's a shame. The reason that we are in this awful position way down among the rank of nations is that we do not have a national strategy to get broadband out to all of our people. We are probably the only industrialized country on the face of the earth who lacks such a strategy. And in some fundamental ways, we have gone in the opposite direction of discouraging competition with some of our telecom policies. I won't get into that right this minute, but you're absolutely right. We are, depending upon the study that you're reading, 15 or 21 or 24th or even worse among the ranks of the nation. I think ITU had a study last year on the Digital Opportunity Index. It had us 24th, right behind Estonia and tied with Slovenia. That's not where the United States should be. We talk about we're going to keep this country competitive in spite of the outsourcing of so many basic jobs by high technology and innovation and entrepreneurship, and here we look at the place where high technology is and where entrepreneurship is, and we see that we're not doing what we should be doing to cultivate it. So we need to get a strategy. We need to learn what other countries are doing to get broadband out to their folks, not that we need to mimic exactly what they're doing because cultures and peoples are different, but maybe there's some valuable lessons out there, and we have just refused to take a look at that. We need to get serious about analyzing it. You know, the FCC is actually still defining broadband as 200 kilobits up and down. Now, you talk about 1996-ish or whatever. I mean, that's just that's almost antediluvian in terms of the pace of technology development. We're still analyzing the deployment of broadband by saying, gee, if there's one subscriber in a zip code to high-speed technology, that means everybody's got it, and the deployment of broadband is proceeding in a reasonable and timely fashion. That's like coming to Urbana and see somebody driving around in a brand new Cadillac and saying, oh, everybody in Urbana must have a brand new Cadillac. You know, that's a level of sophisticated analysis that we're doing at the FCC. So we need to get serious and realize where we are. And no matter what study you see, and it's interesting because those who think things are going just fine are now trying to find methodological problems with the OECD studies and some of these others that rank the United States so low. But, you know, in 2001, when the OECD said the United States was number four, I didn't see these people questioning the methodology or the conclusions of those studies. The point of the fact is we're on the downward side of the slope. We're getting much less bandwidth, much less bits for the dollar than consumers in other countries. And some will say, well, that's because folks live in high-rise apartments in downtown Tokyo and downtown Seoul. But, you know, folks live in high-rise apartments in New York City and Washington, D.C., too, and I'll take the bandwidth that they've got in Seoul and Tokyo. You know, in addition to that, Canada, where its population is less dense than it is here, or Norway or Sweden or any number of other countries, less densely populated than us are beating us dramatically in broadband. So we need to get serious about it. This is the central infrastructure challenge, I think, of this early part of the 21st century. If you course back through the annals of America's past, almost every generation seems to have some kind of a infrastructure challenge. We settled the country in the early days, so then the infrastructure challenge is how do you get the produce of those settlers, produce and products to market. So as a people, as a government and a private sector operating together, we find ways to build roads and turnpikes and canals and make river and harbor improvements. After the Civil War, we're a great transcontinental power all of a sudden, so we got to bind that country together. So we find ways to build transcontinental railroads. Even in the last century, in the Eisenhower administration, working with the Democratic Congress, had the Interstate Highway Program to take this newly suburbanized nation and tie all parts of it together. Here we are in the first part of the 21st century, broadband being the highways and byways and roads and canals of the information age, and we're having a stupid argument about, oh, that's regulation, or, gee, the market can do that by itself. That's not how we build America. That's contrary to our entire history. So we got to wake up and figure out how the United States, like other countries, puts all of its resources into this game. It's a competitive world.
Probably the one internet policy issue that's really captured the public attention in the past 2 years has been the issue of network neutrality, the issue of whether the cable and telephone companies that controlled 98% of the broadband access in the United States, largely in duopoly or non-competitive markets, should have the right to privatize the internet, decide which websites you get to see, which ones get put on the slow lane, which goes very much against the founding principles of the internet. Where does network neutrality stand right now at the FCC?
Well, the good news is a couple of years ago we managed to get just a kind of general statement of principles that that I put forward adopted as principles. I'm not saying that they really have been implemented to the extent they should, but the right to attach different devices to the Internet so we don't go back to the old Bell telephone days when you could only use their one black telephone and you couldn't apply any of the new devices that the market was capable of producing. So you'd have the right to attach devices, to run applications of your choice, to enjoy the fruits of competition, and to access content of your choice. So that's the good news, but we haven't really ingrained that in all the decisions we have made here. We've had a couple of big telecom mergers where we were successful in getting the companies to offer some commitments on network neutrality to make a real principle of non-discrimination, but those are time-limited and constrained to one or two companies. So we have an awful lot of work to do, but you know what? Those who oppose network neutrality are really trying to invert the fundamental genius of the Internet. The Internet was built, and maybe I simplify too much, but I think the Internet was built with the idea that intelligence would be at the edges, at the people who were putting out the content and who were receiving it and putting out their own content in return. And the pipes in between were kind of dumb pipes, and you wouldn't have a lot of control there. Now these big network providers are saying, no, that's not what we meant. Let's put the intelligence in the pipes and the selectivity in the pipes, and all you folks on the edges, you can go back to being dumb, you know. And that's not what the Internet's all about. That's not what got the Internet where we are in the dial-up phase. But if we deny that genius in advanced broadband, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot. Maybe we're shooting ourselves in the head.
You know, we've talked about Internet research and research in general. Just less than a year ago, Senator Barbara Boxer announced to the public that she'd come across a couple of repressed studies that have been done internally in the FCC, which have been quite critical of media concentration. And for some reason, they were abolished and not never released to the public. And it created somewhat of a scandal that, you know, as the FCC's researcher to cooking the books to come up with a certain type of outcome that was favored by the chair in repressing studies that didn't go in the right direction. What came of that scandal? I haven't heard much about it since then.
Well, I hope we learned our lessons. I think it's still being investigated. I'm not aware that they've had any final results for the Inspector General and others looking at it. We are kind of told that folks have learned their lessons, but we're going to have an opportunity here right quick to see if we've learned our lesson, not so much from the standpoint of suppressing studies, but have there been any preordained outcomes? Because in this current round of media ownership rules that we are presently engaged in, the chairman contracted for, I think, about 10 media studies, new media studies on cross-ownership and diversity and a number of other things. And those have just recently been released. I haven't had an opportunity to read them all yet, but some folks seem to think that maybe there are some methodological or analytical faults in some of those. So that'll be an opportunity for us to check. I think they're being peer-reviewed in some sort of a peer-review process that's not entirely transparent. But we will have the opportunity for public comment. It's not nearly long enough, but I hope that these studies are subjected to as vigorous and rigorous a review as we possibly can do. But you know, we have a lot of experts at the FCC, as you said before, about 2,000 people. We ought to be cranking out reports for our own edification and also for the knowledge of Congress and the public. Not stuff that we have to vote on, but just expert studies, and let them see the light of day. And if people find fault with their conclusions, fine. I think that's one of the functions that an agency that has this level of expertise should be undertaking. But I think we've been a little bit slow in that whole area.
Well, I think, as you pointed out, there's been a concern, public concern, about the quality and commitment of the SEC to research when studies are getting repressed, and and suppressed, and then other studies are being rammed through without necessarily the most thoughtful consideration. And one area of research at the FCC that was more or less discontinued was really keeping close track of minority ownership of media. And a recent study done by Free Press that sort of crunched the numbers that had been sort of laying fallow demonstrated that the figures for minority and women-owned media, radio and television, have been turning in the wrong direction from stated goals of the FCC now for the past decade, and in some cases quite dramatically. You've called this a national disgrace. Talk a little bit about this problem. What can be done about it?
Well, it really is, and I'm very grateful for the study that Free Press did, and others have chimed in too. But this is one of the really glaring issues of this whole media consolidation debate. Minorities now comprise about a third of the entire population in the United States. People of color own a total of only, I think, something like 44 full power commercial broadcast television stations. That's like 3.26% of all stations, 33% of the people of the population. The figures for Hispanics and Asians are no better. In some cases, even worse. We're going to be a minority majority country here, probably by mid-century. And to me, the nation's diversity is not so much a problem to be overcome as it is an opportunity to be developed. It's our strength. But our media has an opportunity to Our media has an obligation to reflect that diversity and to nourish that diversity, and it's not being done. If people don't own those stations, you know, ownership matters. What goes out on a station does get influenced by ownership. That's part of the problem with consolidation right now. Why should we be surprised in light of these statistics that issues of concern to diversity communities and minority groups don't get covered? Why should we be surprised that they're caricaturized so much on radio and on television? Why should we be surprised that the good and positive things that all of these groups are contributing to our national well-being are ignored in favor of, you know, crime or immigration stories or something like that? It's the great untold story. So we're not serving the interests of a third of our population. And in point of fact, if the other two-thirds doesn't know what the third is doing, we're not serving the interests of any of our population by this total abdication. So we really need to get serious about doing something about minority ownership, minority jobs at these stations. Broadcast industry looks a lot worse than other industries, transportation, insurance, things like that, in terms of female employment, minority employment, and all of that. It is a tremendous problem, and when you go around, I remember we had one of our localism hearings out in South Dakota, and some of our Native American friends came out, and you know, the lack of attention they get for their issues and their problems in the local media is just tragic.
Michael J. Copps, Commissioner from the FCC, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We only have about a minute left, and I do want to talk about one final issue we can, Commissioner Copps. Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation is in the process of purchasing Dow Jones, the Wall Street Journal. Is this a slam dunk?
I hope it's not a slam dunk. It could be. I think the FCC has an obligation to look at this. Now, there are some of the corporate lawyers and lobbyists around town to come in and say, oh, there's some precedent from the 1980s that the FCC decided that USA Today, and that paper was a national newspaper, and therefore outside of your purview. That's a long time ago, 1985 or whenever it was. I don't think precedent rules forever. And in terms of the impact of this merger on the public interest in a particular market in New York City, and that is a national newspaper, the Wall Street Journal. It also has several hundred thousand copies a day that are sold there. If you have the Post and that, I would think that that has some implications for the local market. But I think we have a public interest obligation to look at it. And what I've asked for right now is at least get our lawyers looking and our experts looking at what is the role of the FCC. I think we have a legitimate role here. I think we
Commissioner
have an
Copps,
important role.
I want to thank you so much. Unfortunately, I'm being signaled that it's time for us to clear out of the studio. I want to thank you so much, Commissioner Michael Copps, for joining us today in Media Matters. Good luck with your work. Let's stay in touch.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to be on your show.
All right. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, becoming mostly sunny with a high in the lower 80s and north winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 50s and northeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the upper 70s and light northeast winds. This is WILL Urbana, the listener-supported broadcast service of the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. As we mark the 6th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, we ask the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff whether or not Americans are safer and if we are as safe as we can be.
This is a global struggle, and they're interested in hitting Americans, obviously in the homeland, but also Americans in other countries. And they're also going to attack our friends and allies. They're going to try to weaken the bonds that bind us together. But the good news is that these kinds of attacks actually give us better cooperation.
Also, we'll hear some of the survivor voices that are part of the September 11th Oral History Narrative and Memory Project. Filmmaker Philip Rodriguez previews Brown is the New Green, which looks at Latinos in the media. Plus, Emmy Award-winning actor Tony Shalhoub from the hit TV show Monk. This hour on the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news.